We'll go ahead and get started. We're waiting on one additional board member who is en route. So in the interest of time, we'll get through the formalities here. Welcome to City of Knoxville Board of Zoning Appeals. I'm Grant Rosenberg, Chair of BZA. I'll be conducting today's meeting. Alongside of me are the other members of BZA. Tables to my left, your right, are city staff members. Today's meeting will be conducted in the order of the agenda, and agendas are available table near the entrance. Pursuant to BZA's administrative rules, each matter on the agenda will be considered in the following order: staff comments, proponents, opponents, rebuttals, discussion among board members, motion, second, further discussion among board members, and a vote. Members of the public may address the board, and the following rules apply. Each person may speak once for 5 minutes and shall not have more than one time to speak, except that the chair may allow 2 minutes to the applicant for rebuttal. When more than one person wants to speak to an issue, each side is limited to 3 speakers with 5 minutes each. Board may ask questions of any speaker and may allow more time or more speakers by vote. Speakers should limit their remarks to the facts of the case and should avoid repeating comments that have been previously presented to the board. All speakers should come to the podium and speak directly into the microphone. Speakers need to state their name and address for the record. Appeals of BZA decisions are appeals of decisions by the BZA are made to Knoxville City Council. Petition for such appeal shall be filed with Plans Review and Building Inspections Department not more than 15 days from the date of BZA's decision. I'll now ask Ms. Scobie to call the roll.
Christina Bowler. Well, she's not here yet. Ebony James.
Here.
Daniel Odell.
Here.
Grant Rosenberg.
Here. We are absent one member tonight. From an affirmative vote, we need three affirmative votes to pass in a variance.
Here's our fourth right here.
Here she comes. Okay. Has anyone had a chance to review the minutes from March 21st?
I move to approve.
Motion, second.
Motion to approve the minutes.
All in favor, say aye.
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 Ayes have it. Let the record reflect that Ms. Buhler is here. Okay. Go right into our agenda. First item is 4-A-23-VA. This is 415, 417 Lavinia Avenue. Any comments from city staff?
None other than what was provided. We're happy to answer any questions and articulate logic behind the determination.
Thank you. Okay, may the applicant come forward, please. State your name and address for the record.
Hello, I'm Bob Wetzel, and I live at 1015 Lutzel Street. I'm a co-applicant, Gordon Coker, of Eleanor Street is also with us on this application. And we also have our attorney, Daniel Sanders, is here to speak today as well. I just want to kind of open up the talk here. This property that we're going to be talking about is the pre-existing non-conforming use status. This property has clearly been vacant for over 20 years. If you ask anybody that's lived in the community, they'll say it's been vacant for that period of time. And in your packet, I sent you a thing from KUB that shows the usage pattern. And just so that you'll know, KUB can tell you whether there is or is not a meter. And then if they talk about, has there been any consumption, how much consumption has been on that meter, it can only go back 5 years. So if there could have been no consumption even earlier than that, that they can only go back 5 years. So just to get to the heart of the matter, there's been no meter in a number of these properties since 2004. Four out of the six, there's been no meters operating there at all since 2004. And since 2018, there's only been one water meter at the property, and it's only had a minimal bill, like what it takes to keep that meter on. So clearly there's been nobody there for the last 5 years. So our contention is going to be today, and Daniel will talk to it in more detail, is this property lost its pre-existing non-conforming use under the old zoning code. Even before recode, it was an abandoned use structure that had nothing going on in it. Forever, it was the Lutzel Lavinia Apartments, had a lot going on in it. So there's that. And then there is the The other thing that Peter talked about, and it's in our appeal, is the actively marketed clause of the current zoning code. If you get there, we have some real concerns about how that the documents used to show that there was marketing. We think that's it's a business listing. It's not a marketing document. It just says, here's the businesses in Knoxville. So anyway, so that's our basic appeal, is we feel like it's an abandoned use because of its long-term vacancy under Section 17 of the code. And I'm going to let Daniel speak in more detail on that.
Good afternoon, Daniel Sanders, 900 South Gay Street, Suite 2102. This is essentially a legal argument. These non-conforming use provisions in a zoning ordinance are exceptions to the general rule of applicability of the remainder of the zoning code. So the law of exceptions states that the exception has to be applied strictly in order to come within the exception. The applicant, which is the property owner in this case, has the burden of proof. And so from what I can tell by what Mr. Wetzel has provided you, the property at 415, 417 Lavinia Street was zoned R1A back in the 1980s. The recode ordinance took effect on August the 13th, 2019. At that time, the property was zoned RN2. Multi-family dwellings or multi-family structures aren't permitted under either zoning designation. So the use of the property as a multifamily dwelling or a multifamily structure would have been non-conforming 40 years ago, longer than I've been alive, essentially. So that's how you get to this non-conforming use idea. Section 17.1 of the current zoning ordinance permits certain non-conforming uses to continue as legal non-conforming uses. To come within the protection of that statute, the current use provision, the applicant has the burden to prove that the use existed legally on August 13th, 2019, and that the use has not been discontinued for more than 24 months during the time of nonconformity. Importantly, Section 17.1 expressly prohibits the interpretation or construction of the ordinance, quote, to authorize the continuance of any legal or nonconforming use which was illegal prior to the adoption of the ordinance in 2019. So if the proposed use was not legal, nonconforming on August the 13th, 2019, it can't be continued under the recode provisions for nonconformity. So to determine whether this use was legal prior to August 13th, 2019, you got to look at the prior zoning ordinance. The prior zoning ordinance also allowed certain nonconformities to continue as legal nonconforming uses. Under that code, it was Article 6, nonconforming building structures and uses. The applicant or owner had the burden to prove, one, that the use of the building as a multi-dwelling structure existed legally on the effective date of the zoning change back in 1980, and then that the building or structure or portion thereof did not become vacant or remain vacant or unoccupied for a period of 6 months. So for, you know, a stretch from 1980 to 1919, you guys have to find that it was legal, non-conforming to begin with in the 1980s, and that during that time it wasn't vacant. Otherwise, you don't get to recode. You just lose your non-conforming status. And so that provision likewise provided that if you lost your non-conforming use status, you know, you can't occupy the building after that time. So in summary, as I guess you got to go through two steps of analysis. One is under the prior code and the other is under the current recode. If you lose your status, non-conforming status under the prior code, you can't survive under the current code. So you apply that to the facts that Mr. Wetzel's provided you in your packet. All but two units went vacant in 2005. They've remained vacant since that time. So use at that time, when those all but two units became vacant, the use would have been considered a duplex under the prior code. So no later than 2006, 6 months after they went vacant in 2005, this property would have lost its legal non-conforming use status as a multi-dwelling structure under the prior code. And, you know, I just don't know how you don't get past that with more than two units. If you move on into recode, you know, somehow you might get to recode with two units, but I don't even think under the facts that you get past recode with two units, because this, you know, it's been vacant since 2019. You got to rely on this argument that it's been actively marketed. You know, the information's in your packet. I'll just leave you with this. If this is considered active marketing in today's world, it's a mockery of the code, and it's a misuse of language. And we would believe that the neighborhood association would be aggrieved by this decision if you were to deny this appeal. Obviously, Mr. Wetzel and Mr. Coker would be aggrieved. And with that, I'll leave it to you, and would like to have some time for rebuttal, I suppose. Thank you.
Okay, is anyone here to speak in opposition of this appeal?
My name is Jim Clonaris. My address is 719 Luttrell, which is about 40 yards away from this particular property. About 13 years ago, I moved into the neighborhood that we're talking about, and my son also moved in 2 years prior. And instantly, when I moved in, I started trying to purchase this particular property. It had been under demise for many years, as a lot of the Monday properties had been. Many people have tried to purchase this property. A lot of them are in the room, interestingly enough, speaking in opposition of this. But my intent, as is always my intent in a historic area, is to preserve properties as best we can. I have preserved five properties in the Fourth and Gill area over the past 5 years, plus my own home over 11 years ago. And my intent with this property from day one, when I was able to pry it, if you will, out of the Monday's hands, was to convert this property into a fourplex, which is what the property was designed as when it was built. Over the years, it became a sixplex, as was just described, and I want to bring it back to what it was originally when it was built, which was a fourplex. So we intend, you know, to restore the exterior of the building to its original sense in perfect form, take it back to a fourplex, which it was originally, and have some density in our neighborhood. I have parking spaces for every tenant under a fourplex. I additionally have leased more parking behind the building from the Mondays. They own an entire parking lot down the alley, and they've leased me that space also for even additional parking. So it's not a parking issue. This has to do with codes and recodes and all of that, but there's also common sense here. We're trying to build something that has been an eyesore in the neighborhood for as long as I've lived there, 12 years. And as Mr. Wetzel has spoke, over 20 years, and he's probably lived in the neighborhood more than 20 years. So that's all I can say about this.
Thank you.
If it's all right, I would like to speak, and then also attorney representing the owner. So well, thank you all very much. I want to speak as the
Your name and address, yes, for record.
Logan Higgins, 133 South Gay Street. I want to speak as the architect representing the owner of the property, not the applicant. The applicant is a neighbor with no interest or equity in this property. And what I'd like to do is kind of go through the process before you know that got us here, and then also respond to a couple things that were mentioned and discuss broader about the city. So first and foremost, the owner of the property, when he got it under contract, is as part of his due diligence, we went through the process to ensure that this would be usable as it was without a variance, or, you know, a rezoning or some sort of special approval. So we asked for asked if that would be okay, and then discussed the possibility of the conversion from a sixplex to a fourplex instead of maintaining the sixplex status. And we're told that that would be viewed the same way because it's multifamily, so that downsizing and density would be in line with the way it has been viewed and historically used. This application coming in was a complete surprise to us. There was no prior conversations with the owner about their intent, or, you know, if any efforts to try to work together, if the neighborhood or a specific neighbors have any problems with the owner's plans. There were no attempts made to try to figure something out with that. But there were a couple things mentioned. There was one about the utilities, and yes, there's not been active utilities, but the meters have not been removed. If you go out there, there's still 6 meters on this building, 3 on each side. The use was never discontinued necessarily. It's just has had vacancy. It has never been turned into a different use. And you know, if you look at Fourth and Gill as a neighborhood, a lot of the houses even on this in this neighborhood are, if we look at what dictates what can be multifamily, it's the square footage size of the lot. Or even single family, or even if you can build something on a lot. Most of the houses in Fourth and Gill do not meet those dimensional standards for the underlying zoning. And so I wonder if a house were to go empty for a certain amount of time, and then, you know, it stayed a house, it was still a single family house, and someone went to get a permit on it, would there be similar opposition? Even, you know, if it did not meet the dimensional guidelines. And I don't think that there would. I do think that this is tied to the multifamily aspect, which on that same point, I don't know if you all have seen the report that the city had done on missing middle housing recently. And if you look at that report, you know, it talks about not just the need for missing middle housing broadly, but specifically in our own community. And it highlights specific areas that are ideal for missing middle housing. And wouldn't you know it, Fourth and Gill is one of those areas. So what we're looking at here is an example of the very thing that our city is working hard to create more of, an existing use. And a new owner has bought it in an effort to bring it back to life and to get new faces in there, new neighbors in there, and there's, you know, opposition to that. And so I think if you look at the size of this lot, it's 4,500 square feet underlying zoning. If we were not allowed to do multifamily, I do think there's, you know, other ways to do single or two family, but just looking at the dimensional standards, this isn't permitted. This zoning doesn't allow any use, doesn't even allow a single family house with this lot size. So we're looking at absolutely a non-conforming use that in this scenario. I mean, it's the facts are very clear with the history, and I think it would be absurd to try to remove this use from our housing stock, what's available. So that's pretty much the summary of my thoughts and the process that we've been through. And I think the city's stance on this makes a lot of sense. It speaks for itself. And then I'm also going to step aside because in talking about what this case is actually about, the legal use, I think attorney Ben Mullins has some thoughts on that. Thank you all.
Thank you. So Mullins, if you keep your time brief, we've gone over the 5 minutes, but
I will all do my best, but you know, as lawyers have laws to quote. Ben Mullins, 550 West Main Street, here for the property owner. And what Mr. Clonaris should have said, this was originally permitted as 6 homes. He's converted it to 4 condo homes, and those are going to be condoed out. They're not going to be leased, but these are going to be 4 homes that will be sold. Mr. Sanders is right. This is a legal argument, and lawyers love to talk about laws. They love to talk about burdens of proof. Mr. Sanders talked about the burden of proof on an exception to try to establish a pre-existing non-conforming use being on the person trying to establish that non-conforming use. And that would be correct if we were not here on this interpretation. Right? In the context of this, Mr. Ahrens has made an interpretation that they are trying to overturn. They have the burden of proof. And I cited you some case law on the issue of trying to establish whether or not a non-conforming use had been abandoned. The burden of proof is on the entity, Mr. Wetzel, seeking to establish the abandonment by clear and convincing evidence. Now, that may not mean a lot to some of you, but I'm sure Ms. James understands there's different levels of burden of proof. Beyond a reasonable doubt is the highest. Clear and convincing is just below that. And then there's the preponderance of the evidence. So the burden is on them by clear and convincing evidence to show abandonment. And abandonment is what we have to focus on here, because I think they've cited some facts as, well, clearly it's abandoned, but the case law that has looked at very, very similar facts in two other cases has shown that mere non-use, vacancy by itself does not establish that a non-conforming use has been abandoned. There must be some overt act, some intent to abandon that non-use by itself doesn't show. And there's two cases. I cited one of them I spoke about in detail. If you have my letter, does everybody get a chance to see my letter? That's the Lamar Advertising versus Town of Farragut, 1986 Court of Appeals case. And in that case, the Town of Farragut had their nonconforming use said if its lack of use of a structure for 365 consecutive days was abandoned. There were several billboards in the Town of Farragut they wanted to get rid of that hadn't been used for several years. And the court said, that's not enough. The fact they haven't been used, they are available for use. There's not always a market for it, but they are still available to be rented. And the court said then that mere non-use will not amount to an abandonment. And the burden, again, is on them. Now, I also cited in a footnote this Tennessee Supreme Court case of Ready Mix USA versus Jefferson County. And I can talk a lot more about that because Arthur and I tried that case in Jefferson County. In front of the chancellor, and chancellor again found this was a quarry. This quarry had been not in use for over 80 years. It had grown up. We had converted the taxes to greenbelt. We had leased it to a farmer who had some orchards on it and had some hay on it. When Jefferson County established their zoning ordinance, they said you can no longer open this as a quarry. And we sued over that. And the Court of Appeals, the trial court, and ultimately the Tennessee Supreme Court said yes. It was used as a quarry before. It was still owned by somebody who intended to use it as a quarry sometime in the future. And so that in and of itself, the fact that you changed the tax status, that you leased it out for some other use, it still could be opened up as a quarry. It did not lose its pre-existing non-conforming status. And that's a 2012 Tennessee Supreme Court case. That's really what we have here. We have a property that was intended to be a fourplex. At some point, it was converted to a sixplex. At many points, parts of it were vacant. Now, Mr. Sanders said at one point only two units were occupied, so that converted it to a duplex. And I take issue with that characterization. I think it was a sixplex that only had two units occupied at that point, but it was still being used. And the fact that it was vacant for some period of time, but it was still marketed, actively marketed for rent. And that, so it shows that there was no intent to abandon the property. So it did not lose its non-conforming use either under the old ordinance or the new ordinance. So it is still available. And what we're doing now is kind of converting it back to its original intent, what it was when it originally designed. Now, they argued some precedent that, well, if we don't uphold the zoning ordinance and we overturn Mr. Aaron's wise interpretation here, that it's somehow going to undermine the entire zoning ordinance. This is a very unique circumstance. You don't see this very often. It's a case-by-case scenario that happens very rarely. And it would every time this comes up, it's going to go to Mr. Ahrens, and he's going to look at the facts and make an interpretation. If someone disagrees with it, they can come here. But as it stands, this property wasn't abandoned as that term is interpreted by the Tennessee Supreme Court. So I think you should uphold the appeal and allow it to continue to be converted to this light touch density, which is something that Mr. Higgins touched on, is something this community is actually looking for ways to promote and find ways to make that happen in neighborhoods such as this. Thank you.
Thank you. The applicant for rebuttal.
Number one, it appears that Mr. Mullins has submitted some sort of letter to you guys, but we don't have a copy of it. We would object to that as an ex parte communication. We don't know what's in the letter. We haven't had a chance to rebut it. This is a de novo hearing. You guys have the ultimate authority to overrule or impose conditions or affirm this appeal. The applicant clearly has the burden of proof. And if you think otherwise, we think that's a misapplication of a legal principle. Mr. Mullins talked about abandonment versus, I don't know, vacancy. The language in the ordinance uses the term, the prior ordinance used the term vacancy. The current ordinance uses the term discontinued use. You got to focus on the language in the ordinance and not whether the Supreme Court was considering a case of abandonment under a mining statute. You got to read the ordinance. Because there's been no proof here. I mean, they seem to agree with us that it's not been, it's been vacant for many, many years. So I just don't think there's any proof for you guys to make a finding and uphold the zoning administrator or the building administrator's decision. We ask you to uphold the appeal and overrule the decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I'd like to open up to the board for questions.
Chris, I'm not an attorney. De novo and ex parte communication. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. Basically, the letter that Mr. Mullins sent in, I believe, was emailed to Ms. Scobie. Ben is nodding his head for the record. But it was not sent to the board members individually or as a group. It was sent to Ms. Scobie for inclusion in the packets to you all today. That in turn is posted online, as you all are very well acquainted with. That is not ex parte communication. Ex parte communication basically is where you have two parties that are in front of some kind of a judicial or quasi-judicial board, such as yourselves in this capacity, and one of the parties attempts to persuade the fact finders without the other party being present and having a fair chance to defend their point of view. And that's not what has occurred here.
Yeah, I see the letter is in our packet, which is posted on the website.
That's correct. And you all did not receive it individually or as a group before this meeting. That's correct. Right. Uh-huh.
Christina, we'll keep you on the mic here.
Yes.
Since attorneys are talking. Can you speak a little bit to the burden of proof on either the applicant or the opposition in this case? Can you speak to that?
Sure.
Some disagreement among the.
I think as far as the decision that was made, I think I'm going to have to turn that over to Peter Ahrens as far as his decision-making process is concerned. Do you want to detail the method that you use to make the decision in this case?
Is that information that you're looking for?
Not really, but it's okay. I would like to hear from Mr. Ahrens.
Oh, okay. I apologize. I must not have understood your question then.
Each of the attorneys before us were talking about who has which side has the burden of proof to provide evidence to overturn the decision. There was some disagreement among each attorney that came before us. Could you weigh in on that?
So in terms of an appeal that is filed, which is of a zoning code administrator's decision, which is what is before you today, the burden is on the party that has filed the appeal.
Thank you for clarifying. Mm-hmm. Okay. Peter, I would like to hear from you in terms of your rationale and basis for the decision.
Sure. So we received a request for a zoning letter, which is intended to identify what can and cannot be done in accordance with the zoning code. We get those all the time. That's where we do our research to see what the last legal use was. And that's where we found, we did find building permits from, I believe, 1953. converting the existing structure into 6 apartments. And so we looked at it. It appeared to be, continued to be a 6 unit. We did a quick Google search on the address. It sent us a link to Monday Properties. And so we found that to be an active listing because anybody interested in the property could do exactly that. So therefore, because we can agree it was not abandoned, it was not occupied, but we had to determine whether or not it met the requirements of discontinuation or abandonment, which is 17.1D. And that does talk about discontinued use for a period of 24 months and is not actively marketed. I know going back to the recode days, that was a big deal, that information, that and actively marketed, was added to that definition and those requirements for the purposes of, if somebody's having a hard time renting their space, they don't necessarily lose the legal use of it.
Is actively marketed defined anywhere?
I believe it is. In the world. Let me look. Actively marketed, as defined by our zoning code. A property is considered to be actively marketed when it is marketed continuously online through professional multiple listing services, such as, but not limited to, Realtor.com, Flex MLS, Knox Area Association of Realtors, Commercial Information Exchange, LoopNet, CoStar, and Zillow, and or has signs indicating the property is for sale or lease. Now, can I guarantee that it was continuously marketed? No. We don't have those capabilities, but our brief search revealed that it was in the hands of a realty company.
And so just to clarify one thing, as far as the burdens go, today the burden is on the party that filed the appeal, but that is the burden that exists currently, because Mr. Aarons determined that the property owner met the burden of showing that the non-conforming use was not discontinued or abandoned for 24 months and actively marketed. So I guess in a way the burden question is, it's kind of both, but today just with what's before you is on the applicant who has filed the appeal.
Thank you. I'm sorry. You can come to the podium, yes.
So Mr. Aaron's comments, for what they are worth, he did not do the analysis under the prior code. And under the current code, you have to establish that it was a legal non-conforming use on the date of the zoning change, which was August of 2019. Our argument is that it lost its legal non-conforming use status prior to that. And Mr. Aaron's has not done that analysis.
Let me ask a question about that, though. I mean, the last permits pulled were back in 1953. Okay. There had been no impetus to have a legal nonconforming use, I don't believe, until after. If the permit's not ever pulled, there's no determination that ever gets made from that point forward. So I'm really not understanding your argument, and I'm not just being facetious about it. I don't understand that, what the nuances that you're trying to make about that.
Daniel,
sure, we're great.
So I think Mr. Mullins agreed with me. This idea of this legal non-conforming use status has got to be taken on increments of time. And when
they're both so tall and we're having a hard time hearing through the mic.
I'll talk to the microphone. I'm sorry. So let's assume we don't know. In 1953, when he pulled a permit to build remodel this into a sixplex, that was somehow a legal conforming use in 1953. The zoning code in 1980 changed. There was a zoning change in 1980. A sixplex became non-conforming. The question was, could it continue as a legal non-conforming use?
Okay, so if there had been a permit pulled and they came to BZA, which would have happened, I think, for numerous reasons, from what I hear, they would be pre-existing non-conforming, which is a very common thing this board said yes to for recode, especially in this neighborhood, all over the place. There's pre-existing non-conforming everywhere. All the lots are undersized under the prior code. And so I'm having a hard time understanding why that's an argument. If they pulled permit, if the Mondays had pulled permit, wanted to do renovations, they chose not to do renovations, but they wanted to do renovations.
In 1953.
Right.
Okay.
I understand. But in 1980, when you're saying this, when 80, whatever it was, when this became non-conforming at that time, if they come and pulled permit, they would have come to this board and had to have asked for a pre-existing non-conforming compliance in some way. Like, the building has setback issues. There's lots of things with that structure that don't conform.
Sure.
Okay. This board would have said yes to that in order to allow for the beneficial use of the property.
Well, I think that's speculative, and you would have gone through the analysis at that time. Is it currently a legal non-conforming use, or is it simply non-conforming? You can lose your legal status as a non-conforming use.
But then the argument's backing all the way up into whether or not it was marketed or not in that standpoint.
Am I wrong? The active marketing provision did not exist under the prior code. And in 2005, when it became vacant.
But the other piece of that is only the use of it, right? The use was established, right?
No, you have got to pay attention to the language of the ordinance. And I have them both here. You know, I don't have
more. We do have in our packet right in front of us.
The prior zoning ordinance, the first two paragraphs were very similar to the current ordinance. Land uses which existed legally upon the effective date of the zoning change can continue under certain circumstances. Paragraph C is similar to the current paragraph C, but they're different because you had recode. Under the prior zoning code, subparagraph C, with the exception of houses and duplexes, which again is a lot of non-conforming uses are houses and duplexes in our neighborhood. Those don't apply. With the exception of houses and duplexes, a non-conforming building, structure, or portion thereof, which is or hereafter becomes vacant and remains unoccupied for a continuous period of 6 months, shall not thereafter be occupied unless the uses which conform to the use regulations of the district in which it's located. If we assume that prior to 1980 was conforming and legal, in 1980 it became legal non-conforming. If at any point thereafter it became vacant for 6 months, not abandoned, but vacant for 6 months, it loses its legal non-conforming status, and thereafter it can't be utilized except for the R1A or R.
But that never became before us. So we're talking about something retroactive, are we not? I mean, can we retroactively enforce the prior zoning ordinance?
It was before Mr. Aarons, when he had to consider whether to issue the permit, because he's issuing this permit reportedly because section 17.1 of the current ordinance doesn't revive something that lost its non-conforming status prior to 2019.
But who makes
we're here for an appeal of his determination of the current code, correct? We're not here to interpret the prior code, are we? Can I ask that to our attorney?
The issues are so very closely intertwined. You are making a decision as to the appeal before you today, which has to do with the decision that Mr. Aarons made at the time that Mr. Mullen's client sought to revive the use. But in doing so, it does require some looking back at prior non-conforming status, which is the argument that Mr. Sanders is making.
Yeah.
Essentially, okay. Right.
Yeah, and that's,
thank
that's
you.
Because the second paragraph in the current section 17.1, nothing herein shall be considered to authorize the continuation of any illegal or non-conforming use which was illegal prior to the adoption of the ordinance, i.e., August the 13th, 2019, when you adopted.
It actually went into effect on January 1st, 2020. But right. Yes, you're right. The voting date is correct. Sorry, yeah.
I'm saying correct.
Since I was invited to the podium, Mr. Sanders, may I say something? Even looking at the old code, you still have to look at what does it mean to be vacant or abandoned. And he's asking the codes department to do, I think it was an impossible analysis, to go back from 1980 to January 1, 2020 and say, if one of those units were leased, then the property was not vacant. Now, think of it this way. If you have a non-conforming apartment complex before recode, if you use Mr. Sanders' argument, if there is one apartment there that is not leased for 6 months, then that loses its entire multifamily because now it's now, instead of being 14 units, they can only use it for 13 units. That one can never be leased again. That's an absurd interpretation. And there's no way we can go back and historically look at each time during those years, was there not one apartment? How long was it? Was it for 6 months? Was it 4 months? Was it for 3 months? It, you can't do that. And the burden, again, for since it's their appeal, is on them to demonstrate that. And I don't think that can be done. So thank you.
Thank you.
I'm trying to still figure out, too. So we look at the code, the prior code. I'm still stuck on the fact that how is that when triggered at all if a decision was never made as to whether or not it was non-conforming? So we would, it's almost speculative to say that it would, you know what I mean? Like we can't go back to what it was if it was never before us and a determination wasn't made at the time. So, and I didn't hear that little piece that he had read just before now that's changing my thought process on that per se. So
that's extremely tough. And I think you're hitting the proof issue very, very concisely. I think that's the issue that Mr. Aarons undertook was to figure out, did it still have its non-conforming status? And if so, was it legally protected as well? And with the resources that are available to us today, Mr. Aarons made the decision, the interpretation that it was legally protected and nonconforming. Now, of course, if this had been before a prior BZA, say in 1981, we probably wouldn't be having this discussion because there would be a lot more resources. More folks would be here before us today talking about when it was last leased, et cetera. And that would be a much easier question to tackle proof-wise. Right. But using the resources that are available today, which again are, we're certainly not saying are perfect or that we have unlimited resources to track everything down. Like, you know, for instance, maybe a personal a PI firm might have. But this is the decision that Mr. Aarons has made in conformance with the proof that he has been able to find thus far. But so, yes, I think that is, yeah, that's a valid observation. Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. And so when we, in 2019, it said it has to be, was the wording abandoned and actively marketed or just one or the other?
So before the new code went into effect, the language was, I'll just read it. With the exception of houses or duplexes, a non-conforming building structure or portion thereof, which is or hereafter becomes vacant, so vacant and remains unoccupied for a continuous period of 6 months, shall not thereafter be occupied except by the uses which conform to the use regulations of the district in which it is located.
Okay.
So the focus would have been on vacant and remaining unoccupied.
Okay. And then 2019 or the most recent code is what?
That's where you get the actively marketed wording and the abandonment for 24 months. So two things, abandoned for 24 months, actively marketed.
Gotcha. Yeah. And so when we think about whether or not something is abandoned, I do agree with the case law portion of it. When we talk about whether or not something is abandoned, you have to really look at the intent, whether the owners, my understanding is you do have to look at whether or not they intended for it to be abandoned and whether those actions thereafter were aligned with that. So it sounds like they didn't intend for it to be that case, be the case. So, okay, that was super helpful. And then the actively marketed portion of it, that kind of is where I'm stuck on here. So it sounds like it was also posted though, and it was available. He could have rented it out. That was his intent. Is that?
That's the determination that Mr. Aarons made. Would it be helpful for me to read that definition again?
Yes.
Okay. Let me do that real quick. Okay. Actively marketed is a property is considered to be actively marketed when it is marketed continuously online through professional multiple listing services such as but not limited to Realtor.com, Flex MLS, Knoxville Area Association of Realtors Commercial Information Exchange, LoopNet, CoStar, and Zillow, and or has signs indicating the property is for sale or lease.
And it's their burden to show that it was not the applicant's burden. Like in my mind, you said the burden is on the applicant to show otherwise, that it did not meet that standard.
So the burden question is kind of twofold. First, the property owner had to show to Mr. Aarons, right, of course, that it was entitled to legally non-conforming, right, protected status. But then today, what is in front of you, the burden is on the applicant here because they are the ones seeking the appeal.
Okay.
So. Everyone okay with what time?
I am actually had a couple questions, so go ahead.
Mr. Wetzel.
Two things I want to get into the record here. First, we have a 1903, I think most of y'all are aware of the Sanborn insurance maps. If you go to that and the city directory at that time, this building was built as a duplex. I think we need to get that in the record today. It was not a fourplex. It was built as a duplex. And then secondly, since we're moving on to the business directory, I thought it'd be interesting for y'all to see what the United States, this all biz says that they do. What is their margin? So if you could, I'd like to pass this out to the group as well.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I don't know how this changes. Just threw it on the table.
So, and clearly, it was never marketed by anything that we think of as being marketed in this town. And that's just a name and a number here. So I throw that up for your information.
Mr. Watts, I have a question that's not legal. I don't.
Yeah. Good. I'd like to try to deal with that.
Thank you. I think it's fair to say you represent the neighborhood over there. You've been here before. I mean, you generally represent Fourth and Gale, I think.
Correct.
We're talking about two units.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this a big deal to the neighborhood? There's several people here from the neighborhood that care about this, but they're going from 6 to 4. It was originally permitted for 2, created for 2. We're only talking about 4. Why is this in front of BZA?
Because there's a process. We had a building that's been vacant for 20 years, and all the clear reading of the rule says if they've been vacant in use, whether it's old or the new, for that kind of period of time, it's lost its pre-existing non-conforming use.
That's a legal answer. I'm asking, why does this matter so much to the neighborhood?
Because we believe in the process. We believe that we've got to where we've got by everybody going through the process at this point in time. So what would happen here if this is denied, he would have to probably go back through this process to determine how many legal units he could put in that building. I mean, you got a 4,500 square foot lot. So people want to see that really well developed. And Jim's done some good work over there. There's no question about it.
Okay.
There is a sense of the intensity of use. It was built as a duplex. A lot of people would like to see it go back as a duplex. I think a lot of people would be fine with a fourplex. Up until today, or until an email I got a couple of days ago, all I'd ever heard was a sixplex. So this fourplex is a new discussion. So there's people want to see it developed in a very positive way. There's nobody against the development. It's not about the developer either. It's just about going by the rules. Again, it's a very special, nice piece of property done in a good way. Okay. Any other questions?
Okay. No, I would like to offer the rebuttal to the opposition if they want to.
I just have to say one thing. And what I don't understand is when I bought the property, I went through the process. I contacted the city. We went through an architect. We started design. I've spent a fortune with Logan on the design of this project as a fourplex based on the city's understanding. Peter Ahrens is not an idiot. He does his job. The city and this board should allow him to make his determination. I subsequently purchased the property based on that information. This opens up a big can of worms, guys. I don't know what happens. I don't even know what these people want. I mean, I know they don't like duplexes in their neighborhood. They don't like fourplexes. They love to talk about density unless it's in their neighborhood, our neighborhood. I live there too. It just doesn't make sense. There's no common sense here. And Bob is right. I do really good work on these old properties. The best. And they will be proud of it when it's all said and done. I mean, I've gone as far as to lease additional parking to get more cars off the street. I don't know what we can do. And I disagree. I don't think it was built as a duplex. Based on the Mondays and their history of the property, it was built as a fourplex.
But you're going to keep it a fourplex.
I want to take it from, it's currently a sixplex. It's horrible.
Or turn it into a fourplex.
Yeah, it's not, you couldn't live in it as a sixplex.
Okay.
The entire rooms are less than 300 square feet. It's silly.
He could make it a sixplex.
It's going to be, the intent behind this was to create four affordable homes. I'm not holding this property and renting it. I don't have a single rental property. I sell my properties to people. I want people to have affordable housing. We talk about density all the time, especially in the 4th and Gill area. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to bring affordable. This will not be an affordable home for two. There's no way anybody could do it because the property is in such demise. It's going to take way too much money. But you can get four really good one-bedroom homes in this for professionals. The neighborhood is full of professors from UT. They will love this. That's all I can say about it.
Thank you. Okay. Any other comments, questions from the board?
Okay. My comments are that based on Peter Ahrens' explanation of how he came up with his determination, I find that to be a reasonable explanation. And I do think in part because the owner has based their purchase of the property on that determination that the arguments brought against that determination are not just overwhelmingly obvious to me to overturn it. My support is for denying the application.
Would you like to make that?
I will make that a motion that we deny 4A23VA for the reasons stated.
I second the motion.
Motion second. Reason I'm in support of your motion is that I've been through this process myself personally on other stuff, and they did follow the process. This is the way it works. You go to the permitting department, you ask them what the prior use was, and you move forward with that. And I don't completely understand what the big deal is with the two other units exactly either. So anyways, but that being said, I find that they did what they were supposed to do. And I think it would be, you know, detrimental if we just upended that right now.
A motion on the floor in a second. Any further discussion?
You do not support the motion?
I didn't hear you. I support the denial.
So there's a motion on the floor to deny the appeal of the interpretation. We have a motion on second floor. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed? Motion passes. Thank you very much. Okay, moving on. Item 4-C-23-VA. 4101 Westgate Drive.
You all don't have to leave. Sorry. I guess I don't have any opposition.
Any further comments from staff?
No further comments.
Okay, thank you. And actually, I'll wait to ask my question. Go ahead, sir.
Please go ahead.
Name and address for the record, please.
My name is Eric Gawthorpe. I'm at 4101 Westgate Drive. And on my way home, I'm going to drive by the 4th and Gill neighborhood and see what it looks like.
Try on your way home.
I'm setting this right here so you all have the idea of what 42 inches looks like. So it's pretty darn low. And put my readers in now. And the reason for my appeal today is I bought this property in December, and previous to me purchasing it, it wasn't in very good condition, and people lived there, but they really didn't take care of the property. We bought it in December, and then my daughter moved into to the building for the 1st of January. And one of the things I was very concerned about from the beginning was privacy and security for her and her girlfriends that are living there. I went to put in, I put in the fence after doing improvements to the landscaping. And when I put in the fence, I went around and I looked at other fences that I saw were up. And I was used to a homeowners association, but there is no HOA there. I should have known more about your codes. But I went around, I saw fences that were taller than mine, and I included pictures of the fence we put in February or March. And my point here is that, and the reason I've asked for an appeal, is that 42 inches is not a privacy fence. It isn't a fence that'll keep a dog in. I have a Labrador Retriever, and your current code says that a fence like mine, which I've included the pictures for you, the tallest it can be is 42 inches, which gives no privacy to my daughter and her roommates. The alternative is to lower the fence to 42 inches, which certainly does not limit the view, the access that somebody with bad intent looking at the house could surmise. My house sits on a corner lot. So I showed a picture. I brought a picture on page 3 of the attachment. That's the master bedroom to my house. So a person that's over 42 inches high can look directly into my daughter's master bedroom, master door, which I believe is not something that any one of us would want to occur. The cost for me to put up the fence was about $9,000. In order to put it in compliance, a couple of the choices are cutting the fence down to 42 inches, or apparently I could remove every other slat of the fence 42 inches and above. So I'd have one plank at 5 feet, one plank at 42 feet, and the next plank at 5 feet. which I think would really look very aesthetically unappealing to that house. I drove around today and I found five fences on my phone in that same neighborhood in a very quick 5 second or 5 minute look for that situation. Included in my my pictures, I wanted to show you on page five or six is a picture of my wife standing next to the fence. My wife is 6 feet tall. So I think that that level of fence that we have today looks aesthetically appealing, but also gives a level of privacy that someone walking on two of the corners of my house will not be able to look into the backyard or look into the bedrooms that they would have access to. Our house is also located about, I want to say maybe 300 yards away from the interstate. So that safety aspect is very important to me. And I'm asking for you to allow this variance in my fence. I don't know. We've had the posting. I don't think any of my neighbors are disappointed. In fact, they've been thrilled by the fence, it seems to me. They often come and compliment me on the house and the fence. I don't have any lawyers, so I'm going to be pretty quick today for you all. So where do I go from here?
You can sit down. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your comments. We have to recognize, ask if anybody's here in opposition to this variance. Okay, seeing none. Any questions, comments from the board? I have a question.
Yeah.
How did codes come to find out the non-compliance of this particular fence?
I don't have detailed records of how. We're adjusting our efforts as staff.
Understood.
Okay. And trying to focus on more pressing issues in neighborhoods.
Understood. Thank you. You don't need to speak unless you need to. Any other questions, comments?
I always need to get a reminder on if this was a side yard next to somebody's house and not on the corner, would they have to have this variance? I always forget the rule there.
Yeah, this is a corner lot, and the fence obviously is in the corner side yard.
Right.
If it was behind the house or on the other side, not in the front yard or the corner side, it would be allowable.
So it is the corner lot that's causing this,
correct?
Right?
Okay. The height of a privacy fence in a corner or front yard is limited to 42 inches.
Is it complying on the Westgate Drive side? It's set back five feet, or?
There's a map in your
packet.
Okay. And you can see the.
Yeah, it looks like the setbacks.
Sorry. I guess on the hypothetical, but yeah, the whole fence on the Sprucewood Road side of the house until 5 feet behind that face is non-compliant.
I think from that picture you have up, it does set back off the front of the front of the
setback's house. not an issue.
So I guess in a hypothetical, if there's a house on where Sprucewood Road is instead, then it would be complying.
Yeah. Okay. And Sprucewood is a dead end, it looks like, with just a couple houses past it.
I'll make a motion to approve 4C23BA as it's submitted. Based on having the side yard circumstance facing the road.
I'll second. Further comments, questions?
I feel like approving this is not consistent with our prior rulings, but that's my comment. Sure.
What makes this one different from the prior rulings? Is there a particular point that are decisive?
Well, there was one, thinking back prior rulings, the one in West Hills that we denied, which I think was ultimately reversed, my understanding, by city council.
That's correct.
Which should not inform our vote, by the way. But again, that was a busier road too. So I think it was more visible with, you know, in terms of the context of the neighborhood. That would be my distinction on this one, is that it's kind of a side yard, corner lot, but it's kind of at the end of, it's kind of a dead end road.
It's less harmful. Visibility.
There's no opposition, not aware of any opposition issues with neighbors. I know we're not supposed to necessarily consider that, but I consider it a little bit in context of this.
This one versus that one. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but my perception is this is still set back further than that one.
It was. Yeah, correct.
That one was like right up on.
It was right on the lot line. And that was, yeah, just a different type of neighborhood.
Yeah.
Different context. But it's a fair point.
That's why
I had some meetings without fences.
In favor of it is that I don't perceive this as quite the same. I don't see there's any harm to this one.
So we have a motion on the floor and a second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Any abstentions?
I'll say no.
We have 3 ayes and 1 no. Motion passes. Thank you. Next up, item 4-E-23-VA. Mr. Loncor, thank you. Loncor, did I pronounce that right?
My name is Jeff Loncor. I'm with CESO, and I am located at 2800 Corporate Exchange Drive, Columbus, Ohio. I am a consulting civil engineer with Casey's General Store, representing them on behalf of this case and the next case. This first case is the 4800 Broadway. We are requesting a reduction in corner clearance for an existing driveway along Adair. I can give a spiel, or if there's any questions, like
if you could just explain the nature of the hardship related to the variance, that'd be great.
Yeah. So ultimately the existing driveway is roughly, I think, 87 feet, call it, from the corner of Broadway and along Adair. And ultimately our whole lot line on that side is, you know, I think just over about 150 feet. So the requirement requires our driveway to pretty much move all the way off site. We're already closing one at the southwest corner that's closer to the intersection along Broadway. For obvious reasons, that one's really close. So we've conceded to close that with the hopes that we can keep this one open for site functionality as well as fueling for the fuel tanks that are located in the southeast corner. We've looked into some alternatives about relocating it further, but we still wouldn't meet requirements of that, and it's just not really feasible. If we were to move it even a little bit, you know, kind of make it better, anytime those fuel trucks are coming, they're going to be sitting right outside blocking that driveway. So it really does us no good. As well as grocery delivery, them kind of pulling up that way as well. So we request that the driveway remain in place. It's out of the way enough to where if those fuel and grocery delivery trucks are there, they will be able to pull up and be enough out of the way that someone could still pull in from that driveway. We would like your consideration for the variance.
Thank you. Anybody here in opposition to this variance? Seeing none. I didn't ask if there are any comments from city staff. Are there any comments from engineering?
None from zoning. We have no objection to the variance.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, comments from the board?
I'll make a motion to approve 4E23BA as it is submitted and for the reasons stated.
The motion?
I second the motion.
Motion and a second on the floor. Any questions, further comments? All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Ayes have it.
Thank you.
Motion passes. Next is 4-F-23-VA, 2218 Cumberland Avenue.
Jeff Launcher here again with CESO 2800 Corporate Exchange Drive, Columbus, Ohio. This one, sorry, I mixed up my notes here. So this one is located along Cumberland Avenue. We are requesting somewhat similar. There's an existing driveway located at the northwest corner of our property that is within the corner clearance desired. It's roughly 50. Just under 50 feet from the intersection along Volunteer Boulevard and Cumberland Avenue. We request that this be allowed to remain as a driveway in general, while also being within the corner clearance per code. Ultimately, we've provided a revised sketch that reduces the driveway to a 3/4 driveway, which would mean it's an enter from, that is the previous one. So it would be, you could enter the driveway with a left in or a right in, and then you could exit, but only right, a right out exit. Ultimately, similar situation. This is a very tight site. Our fuel trucks and delivery trucks come in that way. So it's very pivotal and critical for our operations to work with trucks being able to enter there. And then either kind of pull over to the right side of the canopy for fueling, and then out the northeast driveway, kind of a U loop. And then for grocery, they would pull in and pretty much pull closer to the building, unload, and then enter out the rear there. Mm-hmm. There is some weird grade change along that back, so that also kind of plays into all mm-hmm. of this. We did work with engineering department to kind of get their buy-in, if it hasn't changed, about removing the left out, which was their major concern. So ultimately, we, you know, that's the long and the short of it. And
okay. Thank you.
Thank you for your consideration.
Anybody here in opposition to this variance? Seeing none, any further questions from the board? Is this the last gas station on the strip? Are there any more?
I think it is now.
I don't think there are any more.
No, I think they're all gone. Was the engineering, have any?
Due to the restricted nature of the one write out only that the gentleman mentioned and the minor nature of all the other variances, we have no objection.
Thank you. Yeah, I saw that. That's good. That was a good change of having the write out only. It's congested there. How much you can do with the site, though? I'll go ahead and make a motion to approve 4-F-23-VA as submitted.
Second.
The motion and second on the floor. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed? Ayes have it. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. No further business before the board. We do have a training.
That was my next thing. We have that on the 25th, 3-5 in room 461.
Thank you all for coordinating that. No further business before the board. I'll adjourn. Thank you.